This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Dark of the Moon, written by John Sanford, read by Eric Conger. Chapter 1. 6 garbage bags full of red cedar shavings, purchased 2 at a time for $1 a bag, at midnight, at the self-serve shed at Dunstead & Daughter Custom Furniture, serving your fine cabinetry needs since 1986. No cameras, no lights, no attendant, no theft, no problem. Mooney stacked the bags in the basement, cross-Canadian ragweed pounding through the iPod earbuds, singing about those dead red lips. Then up the stairs, pulling the earbuds, to where the old man lay face down on the rug, shaking, kicking, crying, trying to get free. Tied with cheap hemp rope. But no matter, the old man was so old and feeble that string would have worked as well as rope.
"Please," he groaned. "Don't hurt me."
Mooney laughed, a long singing rock and roll laugh, and at the end of it said,
"I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm gonna kill you. What do you want? I can tell you where the money is. The money's not what I want. I've got what I want."
Mooney gripped the rope between the old man's ankles and dragged him to the basement stairs, and then down the stairs, the old man's face banging down each tread as they went.
"Oh, my Jesus, help me!"
The old man wept through his bloody lips, his fractured face.
"Help me, Jesus!"
Thump, 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 9 times.
"Jesus isn't gonna help," Mooney said.
The old man pulled it together for a second.
"He can send you to hell,"
he snarled.
"Where do you think I am, old man?" "You shut up. I'm working."
Getting the old man onto the bags was the hardest part. Mooney first threw him face down on the topmost bag, then heaved his feet up. The old man was tall, but frail. 82 years old, and sedentary, and semi-senile, though not so senile that he didn't know what was happening now. He sank down into the bags of wood shavings and thrashed there, got halfway off, then sank down between them, thrashed some more, then quit. Wood shavings made for the most intense fire and left no obvious residue, or so the arson fans theorized on the internet. Mooney got busy with the first 5-gallon can of gasoline, pouring it around the basement, around the bags, soaking the old man with it, the unused wooden canning racks, the seldom-used workbench, the stack of aging wooden lawn chairs, and then up the stairs. The old man began thrashing again, moaning.
"Please."
The first few splashes of gasoline smelled good, like the shot you got when you were pumping gas into your car. But down in the enclosed space, 5 gallons of gas, the fumes got stiff in a hurry.
"Don't die on me. Wait for the fire," Mooney called,
backing up the stairs, splashing gas along the steps. The second can was poured more judiciously around the first floor, soaking into the Persian carpets, leaking around the legs of the Steinway grand piano, flowing into the closets. When 2/3 of it was gone, Mooney backed through the kitchen, where the first can, now empty, waited. Mooney would take them. No point in making the arson obvious, though the police would probably figure it out soon enough. A driving rain beat against the kitchen windows. Ideally, Mooney would have preferred to trail the gas out into the yard and to touch it off from a distance. With the rain, though, that would be difficult. The rain would wash the gas away as quickly as it was poured. So it would have to be kept inside. A small risk. The fumes boiled unseen around the killer's ankles, flowing into every nook and cranny. At the kitchen door, Mooney splashed out a final pool of gas, stopped and looked into the house. The place was huge, expensive, and a wreck. The old man's housekeeper came in twice a week, did some dishes, washed some clothes, but she didn't do carpentry, wiring, or plumbing, and the house needed all of it, along with a wide-spectrum exterminator. There were bugs in the basement, and bats in the belfry, the killer thought. And then, giggling now, a nut in the kitchen. The old man cried a last time, faintly audible against the sound of the rain and wind.
"Please, God help me.
Good to know he was still alive. The old man would get the full experience. Mooney stepped through the kitchen door onto the back porch, took out a book of matches, scratched one, used that to set off the entire book. The book cover caught, and Mooney played with it, enjoying the liquid flow of the flame, getting it right. Then threw the book toward the pool of gas in the kitchen, turned, and ran out into the rain. The fire popped to the top of the pool of gasoline, flickered across it, snaked one way into the living room, under the shambles of the once grand piano, and the other way, like a living thing, down the stairs into the basement. The fumes in the basement were not quite thick enough for a real explosion. The old man, surrounded by bags of wood shavings, heard a whoomp and felt the sudden searing heat of a blowtorch that burned away all feeling in an instant and killed in the next. That was all for him. Chapter 2. Coming up on midnight. The rain was pounding down from a wedge of thunderstorms, and Virgil Flowers was running west on I-90, trying to hold the truck against the angling wind. He'd been due in Bluestem before the courthouse closed, but he'd had a deposition with a defense attorney in Mankato. The attorney, a month out of law school with his first criminal case, had left no stone unturned and no verb unconjugated. Not that Virgil blamed him. The guy was trying to do right by his client. Yes, the gun had been found in that dumpster. The dumpster had not been hauled before Wednesday, May 30th, even though it was normally dumped on Tuesday, but everything had been pushed back by Memorial Day. The pizza guy had seen the defendant on the 29th and not the 28th, because the pizza parlor, as patriotic as any Italian food outlet anywhere, had been closed on Memorial Day, and the pizza guy hadn't been working. 3 hours of it. Blah, blah, blah. By the time he got out of the lawyer's office, it was 5 o'clock, too late to get to Bluestem while the courthouse was open. Walking along with Lanny McCoy, the prosecutor in the case, they'd decided that the wise course would be to get sandwiches and beer at Cat's Cradle, the downtown bar. They did that, and some cops showed up, and that all turned into an enjoyable nachos, cheeseburger, and beer snack. One of the cops was very good-looking, and at one juncture had rested her hand on Virgil's thigh. Perfect, if her wedding ring hadn't shown up so well in the bar light. A sad country song. He left the cradle at 6:30, went home, dumped a load of laundry in the washing machine. With the washer rattling in the background, he sat on a rocking chair in his bedroom and finished sewing a torn seam on a photography vest. Sat in a cone of light from his bedside reading lamp, sewing, and wondering about the married cop who'd come onto him, thinking a bit about loyalty and its implications, and the trouble it could bring you. Feeling a little lonely. He liked women, and it had been some time since the last one. When he finished with the vest, he hung it in his gear closet. Guns, bows, fishing and photography equipment. Took a shotgun and 2 boxes of shells out of his gun safe, laid them beside an empty duffel bag. He half-filled the duffel bag with underwear, socks, and t-shirts, 3 pairs of jeans. Still waiting for the washer to quit, he went out on the internet, looking for a letter from a magazine publisher. A letter was supposed to be waiting for him, but was not. He pulled up a half-finished article on bow hunting for wild turkeys, dinked with it until the washer finished the spin cycle, then closed down the computer, threw the wet clothes in the dryer, and took a nap. The clock woke him. After a shower, as he was brushing his teeth, he heard the dryer stop running. His timing was exquisite. He took the clothes out of the dryer, folded them, put some of them away, and some of them in the duffel bag. He threw the bag in the back of his truck, locked the shotgun in a toolbox, stuck a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson semi-automatic pistol under the front seat, and at 10 minutes after 10 o'clock, he was out of town, headed southwest down Highway 60. An hour out of town, he could see the clouds bunching up in the west, lightning jumping around the horizon, while a new crescent moon still showed in his rearview mirror. He hit Windham as the wind front from the first squall line skittered through town, throwing up scrap paper and dead leaves. July was the second best time on the prairie, right after August, The world began to smell of grain and the harvest to come. He stopped at a convenience store for coffee. The long-haired clerk said, "Gonna rain like a cow pissing on a flat rock." And Virgil said, "You betcha." He took a leak himself, got back in the truck as the first fat drops of rain hit the windshield, still moving southwest. He cut I-90 at Worthington, got another cup of coffee, and headed west. Into the Old West, he thought. The real Old West. The Old West of the Sioux, of the high, dry prairie, of the range, of horse and buffalo country, got started somewhere between Worthington and Bluestem. By the time he got there, to the Old West, the rain was thrashing the Forerunner, another deluge in what was already a record wet summer. There weren't many lights this far out, but with the storm, I-90 closed down to a tunnel. Nothing ahead, only a dim set of headlights behind him, and an occasional car or truck in the eastbound lane. He kept one eye on the white line on the right, aimed the car into his headlights, and hoped he didn't run off the road. Listening to satellite radio, outlaw country. Switched over to jazz, rotated into hard rock, and then back to country. Thinking about it later, he didn't really know when he first became aware of the spark. The spark started as a mote in his eye, above the right headlight, deep in the rain. Then it took on a more graphic quality, and he noticed it, and noticed at the same time that it had been out there for a while. The spark was a bright golden hue and unmoving. Another 3 miles, and he identified it. A fire. A big one. He'd seen a few of them at night, but this was up in the sky. How could it be up in the sky and not move? He flashed by an overpass, then caught, a half mile to his right, the red lights of the Jesus Christ radio station, a 500-foot tower. They built them low on the prairie, with red lights that blinked Jesus, then went black, then Christ, and then black, and then quickly, Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ. If he was at Jesus Christ radio, Virgil thought, the spark wasn't in the sky. It was 6 miles ahead, north of Bluestem, on Buffalo Ridge. There was only one thing that could make a spark that big, from this far away, on Buffalo Ridge. Bill Judd's house. The most expensive house for 150 miles around. And it was burning like a barn full of hay. "That's not something you see every night," he said to Marta Gomez, who was singing The Circle on the satellite radio. He got off at the Highway 75 exit, the rain still pounding down, and went straight past the Holiday Inn, following the line of the highway toward the fire up on the ridge. Buffalo Ridge was a geological curiosity, a rock-strewn quartzite plateau rising 300 feet above the surrounding landscape. Too rocky to farm, the mound had kept its mantle of virgin prairie, the last wild ground in Stark County. Sometime in the early 60s, Virgil had been told, Judd built his house on the eastern slope of the mound, most of which later became a state park. Judd was all by himself out there, after his wife died and his son moved out. He was sexually predatory, if not a sexual predator. There were rumors of local women making a little on the side, rumors of strange women from big cities, and of races not normally encountered in the countryside. Rumors of midnight orgies and screams in the dark. Rumors of a Dracula's castle amid the big Bluestem. They were rumors that might follow any rich man who stayed to himself, Virgil thought, and who at the same time was thoroughly hated. Judd had started as a civil lawyer, representing the big grain dealers in local lawsuits. Then he'd branched into commodities trading, real estate development, and banking. He'd made his first million before he was 30. In the early 80s, already rich, when most men would have been thinking of retirement, he'd been a promoter of the Jerusalem artichoke. Not actually an artichoke, but a variety of sunflower. The plant was hustled to desperate farmers as an endless wonder, a food stock like a potato, a source of ethanol as a biofuel, and best of all, a weed-like plant that would grow anywhere. It might have been all of that, but the early 80s fad, promoted by Judd and others, basically had been an intricate pyramid scheme, leveraged through the commodities markets. Farmers would grow seed tubers and sell them to other farmers, who'd grow seed tubers and sell them to more farmers, and eventually somebody, somewhere, would make them into fuel. They ran out of farmers before they got to the fuel makers, and it turned out that oil would have to cost more than $50 a barrel for fuel makers to break even. And in the early 80s, oil was running at half that. The people who'd staked their futures on the Jerusalem artichoke lost their futures. Judd was more prosperous than ever, but hated. Hated enough even to be murdered. Nobody knew where the Jerusalem artichoke money had gone. Judd said it all went for lobbying, for getting bills passed in St. Paul and Washington, for preliminary planning and architectural work on an ethanol plant, and loan service. But most people thought that it went into speculative stocks, and then a bank account somewhere, probably with a number on it rather than a name. The Stark County Sheriff at the time, a man named Russell Copes, had been elected on a ticket of putting Judd in jail. He hadn't gotten the job done, and had shortly thereafter moved to Montana. The state attorney general took a half-hearted run at Judd on the evidence developed by Copes, and there had been a trial in St. Paul. Judd had been acquitted by a confused jury and had moved back to his house on Buffalo Ridge. That was a greater mystery than even the Jerusalem artichoke business. Why did he stay? Stark County was a raw, windy corner of the Great Plains that had been losing population for half a century. Bitterly cold in winter, hot and dry in the summer, with nothing much in the way of diversion for a rich man. Now his mansion was burning down. Everybody in town would know about the fire. Even with the thunderstorm coming through, a half-hundred souls had come out to take a look at it. When Buffalo Ridge became a state park, Judd had donated 200 acres of prairie, which had been expansively appraised and provided a nice tax deduction. As part of the deal, the state built an approach road to the top of the hill, where an observation platform was built so tourists could look at the park's buffalo herd. Judd's driveway came off the road. The way the locals figured it, he not only got a tax deduction for donating 200 acres of unfarmable rock, he also got the state to maintain his driveway and plow it in the winter. Virgil had been to the park a dozen times and knew his way in, threading past a line of cars and trucks pulled to the edge of County Road 8. A sheriff's squad car blocked the park road up the hill, and a crowd of gawkers stood just below it. Even from a half mile away, the fire looked enormous. He eased the truck past the rubberneckers and up to the squad. A cop in a slicker walked up, and Virgil rolled down the window and said, "Virgil Flowers, BCA, is Stryker up there?" "Hey, heard you were coming," the cop said. "I'm Little Curly. Yeah, he's up there. Hey, let me get my car out of the way." "What about Judd?" Little Curly shook his head. "From what I hear, they can't find him. His housekeeper says he was up there this afternoon. He's senile and don't drive himself anymore, so he might still be in there." "Burning pretty good," Virgil observed. "It's a fucking tornado," Little Curly said. He walked back to his car, climbed into the driver's seat, and pulled it through the fence. A woman with a beer can in her hand flipped back her rain suit hood and peered through the driver's side window at Virgil. She was dark-haired, dark-eyed, and good-looking, and she grinned at him and twiddled the fingers on her beer-free hand. Virgil grinned back, gave her a thumbs up, and went on by Little Curly's car and followed the blacktop up the hill. At the house, the first thing he noticed was that the firefighters weren't fighting the fire. No point. The rain meant that the fire wasn't going anywhere, and when Little Curly called it a tornado, he hadn't been joking. Throwing a few tons of foam on the burning house would have been a waste of good foam. The cop cars were parked behind the fire trucks, and Virgil moved into last place. He unbelted, knelt on the seat, and dug his rain suit out of the gear bag in the back. The suit had been made for October muskie fishing and New England sailing. Not much got through it. He pulled it on, climbed out of the truck. The sheriff's name was Jimmy Stryker, whom Virgil had more or less known since Stryker had pitched for the Blue Stem Whippets in high school. But everybody on the hill was an anonymous clump of waterproofed nylon, and Virgil had to ask three times before he found him. "That you, Jimmy?" Stryker turned. He was a tall man, square-chinned, with pale hair and hard jade-green eyes. Like most prairie males, he was weather-burnt and wore cowboy boots. "That you, Virgil?" "Yeah, what happened?" Stryker turned back to the fire. "Don't know. I was down in my house, and one minute I looked out the window and didn't see anything, and the next minute I heard the siren going, looked out the window, and there it was. We got a guy who was driving through town, saw it happen. He said it just exploded." "What about Judd?" Stryker nodded at the house. "I could be wrong, but I do believe he's in there." Up closer to the fire, a man in a trench coat, carrying an umbrella, was standing with three firemen, waving his free hand at the fire, and at the trucks, jabbing a finger. In the light of the flames, Virgil could see his mouth working, but couldn't hear what he was saying. Stryker said, "That's Bill Judd, Jr. He's pissed because they're not putting out the fire." "The New York City Fire Department couldn't put that out," Virgil said. The heat came through the rain, hot as a hairdryer, even at 50 yards. "That thing is burning a hole in the storm." "Tell that to Junior." The fire stank of burning fabrics and old wood and insulation and water and linoleum and oil and everything else that gets stuck in a house, and maybe a little flesh. They watched for another moment, feeling the heat on the fireside, the cool rain spattering off the hoods on their rain suits, down their backs and necks. Virgil asked, "Think he was smoking in bed?" Stryker's features were harsh in the firelight, and the corners of his mouth turned down at Virgil's question. "Bill Parker, he's a guy who lives up in Lismore, was coming into town on Highway 8. He saw the fire, must have been a few minutes after it started. He was driving toward it when a truck went by, moving fast. He figures it was going 80, 90 miles an hour, and it was raining to beat the band. It took the turn on Highway 3, headed down to 90. "You see what kind of truck?" "Nope. Not even sure it was a pickup. Might have been an SUV," Stryker said. "All he could see was the lights was set up high." They looked at the fire some more, and then Virgil said, "A lot of people hated him." "Yep." A few locals sidled past, grinning, hiding beer cans, having snuck past the cops below. "Small town, you took care of yourself." Stryker told them, "You folks stay back out of the way." They watched for another minute, then Virgil yawned. "Well, good luck to you, Jimmy. I'm heading down to the Holiday Inn." "Why'd you come up?" "Just rubbernecking," Virgil said. "Saw the fire when I was coming down 90. Knew what it must be." "God damnedest thing," Stryker said, peering into the flames. "I hope that old son of a bitch was dead before the fire got to him. Nobody needs to be burned to death." "If he did." "If he did." Stryker frowned suddenly, again turned his green eyes to Virgil. "You don't think he might have faked it? Skipped out to wherever he put that money?" "I think the money might be a legend, is what I think," Virgil said. He slapped Stryker on the shoulder. "You take it easy, Jimmy. I'll see you tomorrow." "Not too early. I'll be out here a while." As Virgil walked away, Stryker called, "That money wasn't no legend, Virgil. He's burning because of that money." Behind him, up closer to the fire, Bill Judd Jr. was still screaming at the fireman, looking like he was one step from a heart attack. The Holiday Inn was smoke-free and strictly no pets, but Virgil's room smelled of smoke and pets anyway, snuck cigarettes and cats in the night, as well as whatever kind of chemical they sprayed in the air to kill the smell of smoke and cat pee. "You got two beds whether you wanted them or not." Virgil tossed his bag on one of them, pulled off the rain suit, and hung it over the shower head to drip dry. He was a medium-tall man with blonde hair and gray eyes, a half-inch over 6 feet, lean, broad-shouldered, long-armed, with big hands. His hair was way too long for a cop's, but fell short of his shoulders. He played the big three sports in high school, had lettered in all of them, a wide receiver in football, a guard in basketball, a third baseman in baseball. He wasn't big enough or fast enough for college football, he was too short for basketball, and had the arm for college baseball, but couldn't hit the pitching. He drifted through a degree in ecological science, with a minor in creative writing, because it was easy and interesting, and he liked the outdoors, the botany, and the girls in the writing classes. He joined the army after graduation, got semi-coerced into the military police, saw some trouble, but never fired his weapon in anger. He came back home, found that there was no huge demand for bachelor degree ecologists, and went off to the police academy. Got married, got divorced, got married, got divorced, got married, got divorced. And at the end of a 5-year round of silliness, decided he didn't want to be a 4-time loser, so he stopped getting married. He was working for the city of St. Paul as an investigator, 8 years on the force, getting bored, when he was borrowed by a Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, BCA unit, looking into a home invasion ring. One thing led to another, and he moved to the BCA. There he fell into the orbit of a political appointee named Lucas Davenport, who made him an offer he couldn't refuse. "We'll only give you the hard stuff." He'd been doing the hard stuff for 3 years, with a personal side venture as an outdoor writer. He had credits at most of the magazines that still took freelance stuff, but he wasn't going to make a living at it, not unless he got a staff job, and magazines weren't looking real healthy. Didn't know if he wanted to anyway. Davenport had told him that smart crooks were the most interesting game, and Virgil sometimes agreed. Virgil wore native dress out on the prairie, faded jeans and scuffed cowboy boots and musical t-shirts, and because he was a cop, a sport coat. In the sun, in the summer, he wore a straw hat and sunglasses. He usually didn't wear a gun unless he was in St. Paul, where Davenport might see him. The law required him to go armed, but in Virgil's opinion, handguns were just too goddamn heavy and uncomfortable, so he kept his under the seat of the car or in his briefcase. After hanging his rain suit in the shower, he got a laptop out of his briefcase, went online. In his personal email, he found the note from Black Horizon, a Canadian outdoor magazine that he'd been expecting for a couple of days. They were working late in Thunder Bay. "Verge, I had to take a couple of graphs out of the section on the portage. Nothing I could do about it. It's all about the space. I tried not to hack it up too bad. Anyway, it works for us if it works for you. Get back to us, and I'll stick a check in the mail." He was pleased. This was his third piece in BH. He was becoming a regular. He opened the attached Word document, looked through the edited section. "Good enough." He closed the document and sent a note to the editor. "Thanks, Henry, it's fine. I'll look for the check. Virgil." Whistling now, he went to the National Weather Service, typed in the zip code for Bluestem, got the week's forecast. "Thunderstorms tonight. No shit. With fair skies and warm weather the next 3 or 4 days, thunderstorms possible in the afternoons." He checked Google News to make sure London hadn't been nuked since he left Mankato. It hadn't. He shut down the computer, got undressed, shook the little remaining water off his rain suit, got in the shower, cranked the heat until he couldn't stand it anymore, then turned it up one more notch. He got out, scalded half to death, crawled into bed, and thought about Bill Judd roasting like a bratwurst in the embers of his own home, and a truck speeding away in the night. That would be an interesting murder. Then he thought about God for a while, as he did most nights. The son of a Lutheran minister and a professor of engineering, who saw in God the great engineer and believed as devoutly as her husband, Virgil had gotten down on his knees every night of his life to pray before bed, until the first night he'd spent in the dorm at the University of Minnesota. That night, embarrassed, he hadn't gotten down on his knees, and he'd shivered and shaken in fear that the world would end because he hadn't said his prayers. By Christmas, like most freshmen, he was done with religion, and he mooched around campus with a copy of The Stranger under his arm, hoping to impress women with long dark hair and mysteries that needed to be solved. He'd never gotten back to religion, but he had gotten back some faith. It came all at once, in a bull session in an Army bachelor officer's quarters, when one of the guys professed to being an atheist. Another one, and one who wasn't too bright, in Virgil's estimation, had said urgently, "Oh, but you're wrong. Look at all the wonders of the world. There are too many wonders." Virgil, having grown up in the countryside, where there were wonders, and having studied ecology, where he found even more, had been stricken by the correctness of that statement from the not-too-bright believer. There were too many wonders. Atheists, he came to believe, generally worked in man-made cubes with blackboards and computers and fast food. They didn't believe in wonders because they never saw any. So faith came back, but a strange one, with a God his father wouldn't have recognized. Virgil thought about him almost every night, about his sense of humor, and the apparent fact that he'd made rules that even he couldn't bend. Then at 1 o'clock in the morning, having thought of God, Virgil drifted off to sleep and dreamt of men sitting in motel rooms in the dark, secretly smoking Marlboros, watching their cats ghosting illegally around their rooms. Chapter 3. Tuesday morning. The old town of Bluestem, named for a prairie grass, lay almost a mile north of I-90. Over the years, the space between the old town had filled up with the standard franchise places. McDonald's, Subway, Country Kitchen, Pizza Hut, Taco John's, a Holiday Inn, a Comfort Inn, a Motel 6, four or five gas stations with convenience stores, the Ford dealership, and two used car lots. There were also a half dozen farm and truck service shops, with worn tires stacked outside and muddy yellow driveway puddles from the overnight rain. The old town was prettier. The residential areas were dominated by early 20th century homes, each one different than the next, and big, with porches and yards with swings. The shopping district on Main Street was four blocks long, yellow brick, two- and three-story buildings, including a pre-war movie theater that still showed movies, and all of the businesses left over after you took out a Walmart, law firms, insurance agencies, too many gift shops and antique stores, a couple of small clothing stores, four restaurants, a drugstore. The courthouse was built two blocks back from Main and was still used as a courthouse. In most small towns, the old courthouses had been retired to be replaced by anonymous government buildings and law enforcement centers built outside town. Virgil parked in the courthouse lot, walked past the war memorial. 13 Stark County boys lost in World Wars I and II, Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq, and inside, down the long hall, to the sheriff's office. Stryker's secretary was a heavy-set 50-ish woman with an elaborate pearly blonde hairdo, accented and bias-cut with a couple of tentative spikes sticking out the back, like porcupine quills. She squinted at Virgil, took in the sunglasses and the Sheryl Crow t-shirt with the carp on the front, and asked abruptly, "Who are you?" "Virgil Flowers, BCA." She looked him over again.
"Really?"
"Yep." "Sheriff said for you to go on back." She half-turned and gestured toward the back wall, which had a frosted glass window set in a door that said Sheriff James J. Stryker. Virgil nodded and started past, and she asked, "How many times did you shoot at that man in Fairmont?" Virgil paused. 14. He said. She looked pleased. "That's what I heard. You never hit him?"
"Wasn't particularly trying to," Virgil said, though he'd just about given up on this argument.
"They say he was shooting at you," she said.
"Ah, he didn't want to hurt me," Virgil said. "He was letting off some hot air because he was pissed about being caught. Wasn't really a bad guy, except for the fact that he held up gas stations. Had 8 kids and a wife to feed. Sort of his job, huh?" "And that was about it," Virgil said. "Now he's going to be making snowplow blades for 6 years.
"Huh," she said. "Well, I think most of the boys around here would have shot him."
"Must be pretty goddamn hard-hearted boys," Virgil said, not liking her. And he went on back to Stryker's office.
Stryker was on the phone. Virgil knocked and Stryker called,
"Come in."
And he waved Virgil to a chair and said into the phone,
"I gotta go, but the first minute you find a toenail, I want to hear about it."
He rang off and shook his head and said, "Can't find him. Judd." Virgil eased into the chair. "Nothing in the house?"
"I'll tell you something. When most people build houses, there's a whole bunch of stuff in it that just don't burn too well, Stryker said. He tapped his fingers on his desktop. Anxiety. Judd's house was all wood. Floors, paneling, bookcases, and a good amount of it was pine. Dry as a broom straw. There was nothing left up there this morning but the basement and a few pieces of metal and rock. Refrigerator, stove, furnace, and even those are melted down into lumps. We think he was in there, but we haven't found a thing.
Huh.
I'll tell you, Virgil, if we don't find something, this is going to plague me, Stryker said, and everybody in the county for that matter. We won't know if he went up in smoke or if he's down on some French island someplace. We won't know if that truck last night didn't have Bill Judd in it, headed for the West Indies.
Jesus, Jimmy, the guy's what, 80? Virgil said.
They were saying down at the Holiday Inn that he'd been pretty sick, in and out of the hospital. Why in hell would he sit here for 80 years and then with 6 months to live take off for the West Indies? Probably because he'd think it was funny. Fucking everybody up one last time, Stryker said. He was unsettled, mumbled, son of a bitch, then sighed, looked at two fat file folders on his desktop and pushed them across at Virgil. This is it, everything we got. There's also a DVD in there, all the same stuff if you'd rather use a computer. You need Adobe Reader. All right, Virgil said, but boil it down for me. What'd you get? And what are you looking at now? Virgil wasn't in Blue Stem for Bill Judd, though. He was there for the Gleasons. Russell Gleason had been a town doctor for 50 years, retired for 10. He and his wife Anna lived in an affluent enclave of businessmen and professionals on a hillock above the Stark River Reservoir, a mile east of downtown and handy to the Blue Stem Country Club. Anna had been a nurse for a while when she was younger, and then had gotten elected to the county commission, where she served 6 terms, and then retired for good. They had 3 children, but the children had gone, 2 to the Twin Cities, 1 to Sioux Falls. Both were in their 80s and in good health. Russell still played 9 holes a day at the club in good weather, and Anna had her women's groups. They had a housekeeper, a Mexican illegal named Mahahuel Diaz, who was well-liked by most everyone who knew her, and who came in on weekdays. 3 weeks and 4 days before Virgil came to town, Russell had played a round of golf on a Friday afternoon, the round cut short by rain. He had a few drinks with his golfing pals, then hooked up with his wife. They'd gone to the Holiday Inn for dinner. On the way back home, they stopped at a Super America. A credit card said it was 9:12 when they paid for the gas. At 11 o'clock that rainy night, a neighbor had been sent to town by his wife to get a quart of milk. As he came past the Gleason place, he saw what looked like a strange sculpture, like a dummy or a scarecrow, sitting in the Gleason's backyard, bathed in yard lights. He got a quart of milk and came back up the hill, drove past the Gleason's house, saw the scarecrow, or whatever it was, got as far as his driveway, then said, "The hell with it. That scarecrow was too strange. He'd just stop and ask if everything was okay." It wasn't. The scarecrow was Russell Gleason, propped up with a stick. His eyes shot out. The shootings had happened inside the house. Anna had been shot to death as she sat on a couch in the living room, shot once in the heart. Russell had been shot 3 times, once in the lower back and once in each eye. Then his body had been dragged outside and propped up, staring gap-mouthed and blank-eyed into the dark. It looked like he tried to run, but he couldn't, Stryker said. That the sequence was that he was standing up and Anna was sitting down. The killer shot her in the heart, and Russell turned to run, and the killer shot him in the spine, from the back, just as he got to the dining room. How far was that? How far did he run?
About 3 steps.
I'll get you the key to the house. On the way out the door, we've got a couple in evidence, Stryker said. Anyway, the dining room is connected to the living room, and it looks like he was shot as he started into the dining room. He went down and rolled on his back, and the killer stood over him and shot him 2, once in each eye. God damnedest thing. The slugs were .357 hollow points,
and exited the back of Gleason's head into the floor and were recovered, though in fragments. The eye thing, propping him up in the yard in the lights, a ritual of some kind, Virgil said.
Looks like something, but I don't know what,
Stryker said, shaking his head.
The second shot was a waste of good ammunition, I can tell you that. And the shooter took a risk. The Gleason's house is 350 feet from the nearest neighbor, and it was raining, so the houses were closed up with air conditioning. Still, a 357 makes a damn loud bang. If somebody had been walking by, the third shot was an extra risk.
Excitement? I've seen that, Virgil said. Guy starts pulling the trigger and can't stop.
One in each eye?
He had to take his time, Stryker said. I mean, he fired from 2 feet away, straight down, but you still have to take your time to put it right through an eye.
So he's nuts. A ritual, a revenge thing. Maybe a warning?
Stryker sighed.
What the whole situation hints at, when you boil it down, is that it's somebody from here that we all know. Somebody who went to that specific house at that specific time to do the killing. Somebody that they let into the house. No sign of a struggle by the entrance. There was a glass of water by Anna's hand on an end table like she'd been sitting there a while.
Was it dark?
Probably. We can't nail it down exactly, but they were wearing the clothes that they wore Friday. Russell was still in his golf slacks with a fresh grass stain on the cuff. So sometime after they got gas at 9:12, take them 5 minutes to get out to the house after paying, and before they'd change clothes to go to bed.
Nobody saw any cars?
No. I think the killer, I feel like it's one guy, came up the Stark River on foot, and then around to the front of the house. If he stayed down in the river cut in the rain, hell, nobody would see him. A guy who knows his way around could walk downtown almost without being seen on a dark night.
So tell me what you think, Virgil said.
Who did it? Who might have done it?
Stryker was shaking his head.
I don't know. This is too cold for around here. There might be guys here who could do it, but it'd be hot, lots of anger. Then they'd probably turn themselves in or shoot themselves or run for it or something. So I don't know. You'll hear that all over town, that I don't know. But nobody else does either.
All right, Virgil said. Give me the rest of the day to look at the paper and I'll talk to you tonight. I'll be down at the Holiday. You got my cell number if you need me.
Get you that key on the way out, Stryker said. When you're done with the house, I'll probably let the Gleason kids have it. They want to get it cleaned out and set up for a sale.
Nobody's touched it?
We've been through it, but we haven't taken anything out. Everything's like it was, but maybe a little ruffled.
The evidence room was a closet with a fire door and steel sides. Stryker unlocked it, pulled out a basket, sorted through a dozen Ziploc bags, got the key, and handed it to Virgil. They walked along together to the courthouse door, past a guy painting woodwork.
When they were out of earshot, Stryker said, "Listen, you know how it is in a sheriff's office. Half the guys working for me would like a shot at my job. If they smell a weakness, I'll be in trouble. So, you do what it takes. You need anything from me, anything, you let me know. Any of my people drag their feet? Anybody in the courthouse gives you trouble? I want to hear about it."
"I'll talk to you," Virgil said.
They stepped outside into the sunshine. A woman was going by on the sidewalk, 50 feet away, slender, pretty, small features, white blonde hair on her shoulders. Maybe early 30s? He was too far away to be sure, but Virgil thought her eyes might be green.
She lifted a hand to Stryker, and he lifted one back, and her eyes caught Virgil's for a beat. An extra beat. And then she went along toward the corner.
"Another thing," Stryker said. "We've got this newspaper here, and the editor thinks he's the New York Times. His name is Williamson. He's investigating my investigation, and he says I'm screwing it up. Just a heads up in case he calls you. And he will."
Virgil nodded, then said quietly, "Not to step on your train of thought there, Jimmy, but look at the ass on that woman. My God, where do the jeans come from? I mean, that's an artwork.
That's the Venus de Milo, and you're a bunch of goddamn Germans.
Yeah, Stryker said, a noncommittal note in his voice.
Virgil looked at him.
What? She's married to the mayor? You don't even look at her ass?
No, I don't really, Stryker said. And she's not married. She's been divorced since February. Folks figure she's about ripe for the plucking.
Have you asked her out?
Nope, Stryker said.
They both looked after her as she crossed the street and went on down the sidewalk toward Main.
Virgil said, You're divorced, Jimmy. I know you're not hung up on your ex because she's in Chicago and you hate her. I mean, I hate her, and I only met her once. So here's the woman with the fourth best ass in the state of Minnesota, right in your hometown, and not a bad set of cupcakes either, from what I could see. I mean, pardon me for asking, and not that it matters at all, but you're not queer or something.
Stryker grinned.
Nope.
The woman tossed her white blonde hair as she stepped up on the far curb, and might have glanced back at them, as all women would. She knew they were talking about her. And then Virgil turned to Stryker, about to continue his analysis of her better points, and noticed that Stryker had precisely the same white blonde hair as the woman, and Stryker had those jade green eyes. A thought crossed Virgil's mind. He said,
That's your sister, isn't it?
Yep. They both looked down the street, but the woman had disappeared behind a hedge, at a crooked place in the sidewalk.
Virgil said, Listen, Jimmy, that whole thing about her ass and all, never mind about that, Stryker said. Joni can take care of herself. You just take care of this cocksucker who's killing my people.
Chapter 4 At the Holiday Inn, Virgil spread the Gleason murder files across the bed and the small desk, isolating names and scratching out a timeline on a yellow legal pad. The sheriff himself had served as the case manager, with a deputy named Larry Jensen as lead investigator. A woman named Margot Carr was the crime scene tech, and a variety of other deputies provided backup. The medical examiner was based in Worthington and covered an 8-county area of southwest Minnesota. The pathology looked competent, but didn't reveal much more than the first cop figured out when he got to the scene. 4 shots, 2 dead. Carr, the crime scene tech, had recovered all 4 slugs, but they were so distorted that their use in identifying the weapon would be problematic. The .357 was almost certainly a revolver. Desert Eagle semi-autos, made in Israel, were chambered for .357, but that would be a rare specimen out on the prairie. The fact that no brass was found at the scene also suggested a revolver, or a very careful killer. A heavy load .357 was not a particularly pleasant gun to shoot because of recoil. A lot of samples passed through the hands of lawmen, who were more interested in effect than in pleasant shooting. A .357 would reliably penetrate a door panel on a car, which made them popular with highway patrolmen and sheriff's deputies, who were often working in car-related crime. Something to think about. Jensen and Carr both mentioned in their reports the possibility that the break-in had been drug-related, an attempt to find prescription drugs in the doctor's house. 2 aspects militated against the possibility. Gleason had been retired for years, and anybody who had known where to find him would have known that. And Carr had found several tabs of OxyContin in a prescription bottle in a medicine cabinet, left over from a knee replacement operation on Anna. A junkie would not have missed them. Russell Gleason still had $143 in his wallet. Anna had $76 in her purse. Junkies wouldn't have missed that either. The money hadn't been missed, Virgil thought. The killer simply wasn't interested. The cops had interviewed 50 people in the case, including the housekeeper and all the neighbors, friends, relatives, business associates, members of the golf club. There were some people who had disliked the Gleasons, but in a small-town way. You might go to a different doctor, or you might have voted against Anna when she was running for the county commission, but you wouldn't shoot them. One question popped out at him. Why the lights on the body? The body would have been discovered the next morning, at the latest, sitting as it was so close to the street. If the killer had left the body in the dark, he'd have been certain of more time to get away. Was it possible that he didn't need more time, that he'd come from very close by? Virgil got a map at the front desk and asked the clerk about the Gleason house. The clerk was happy to put an ink dot on its precise location. "You go up this little rise here, and you come around to the right, I think. Or is it left? No, right. Anyways, you see a mailbox down in the street that says Gleason, and the house is reddish-colored and modern-looking." "Thank you." "Folks say you're with the BCA," the clerk said. He was young and ginger-haired and weathered, and looked a little like Billy the Kid. "Yep, we've been asked to look in on the Gleason case. Bring a new point of view," Virgil said. "Seen anything yet?" "Got a couple of things going," Virgil said. He smiled and wrinkled his nose. "Can't talk about him, though. You know, though, you could give me a little help."
"Me?"
"I've had one too many meals here. They're fine, but you know what I mean. Could you recommend another restaurant?" The prairie lands around Bluestem were not exactly flat, more a collection of tilted plains, with small creeks or farm ditches where the plains intersected, the water lines marked by clumps of willow and cottonwood and wild plum. The creeks and ditches eventually collected into larger streams, usually a snaky line of oxbows cut a few dozen feet deep in the soil, and sometimes into marshes or shallow lakes. Sticking out of the plains were isolated ridges and bumps, with outcrops of red rock, much of the rock covered with green lichen. The Gleasons lived on one of the bumps. Virgil took a left out of the hotel parking lot, drove 5 or 6 blocks north into town, took a right on Main Street through the business district, and headed east. He could see the Gleasons' neighborhood as soon as he turned. Straight ahead, a wooded slope with a hint of glass and shingles. He crossed the murky Stark River and drove up the hill, past a couple of well-kept suburban ranch houses and split levels, with decks facing west toward the river. Up on top, coming around to the right, he saw the Gleason mailbox right where the motel clerk said it would be. The Gleason house was built of redwood and glass, with the requisite deck. He pulled up to the garage door, climbed out, remembered what Davenport told him about going into strange houses without his gun, thought, "Fuck it, life is too short," and ambled once around the house, looking at it from the outside. Nice house. Single living level with a basement, a dozen maple trees on an acre of land, reasonably healthy-looking lawn, a garden shed in a cluster of lilacs at the back. The deck looked both west and south over the river toward town and out toward the interstate a mile away. It'd be pretty at night, Virgil thought, but the way the house sat up high, it'd be colder than a bitch in the winter. The northwest wind would blow right up into the garage door. He could see how somebody could walk in with near invisibility, especially in a rainstorm. Park on any of the streets near the edge of town, jog across the bridge, and drop down into the Stark River cut, and follow it right around to the Gleason house. Climb the bank, a matter of 100 yards in distance and 50 feet in height, and there you were. Back out the same way. There'd probably be enough light from the houses along the edges of the slope, and coming in from town, that you wouldn't even need a flashlight. Huh. He finished his circuit of the house, took the key out of his pocket, unlocked the front door, and stepped inside. The inside smelled like a crime scene, like whatever was used to clean up blood, some kind of enzyme. He stepped into the stillness, to the sense of dustiness, and walked through the entry, past the entrance to the kitchen, into the living room. The couch where Anna was shot was in a semicircular niche off the living room, designed as a small theater, and aimed at a widescreen television. The bullet hole was in the far-left back cushion, next to an end table with a TV remote and several magazines, a crossword puzzle book, a wood cup with a selection of pens and pencils, and a couple of books. That was, he thought, Anna's regular spot, because Russell's regular spot was in a leather recliner at the other end of the couch, under a reading light. The bloodstain on the seat and back of the couch had been doused with the blood-eating enzyme. The other scrubbed-out stain was in the entrance to the dining room. There were 3 dug-out bullet holes in the carpet. Standing there, in the quiet, Virgil saw how it must have happened. They knew the killer. Anna was comfortable in her regular spot and hadn't bothered to get up. Russell and the killer had both been standing and fairly close to each other. The killer pulled the gun, if it wasn't already out, and leaned into Anna and fired once. She hadn't made a move to get off the couch. Russell turned, got three steps, and was shot in the back. But they knew the killer, Virgil thought. They must have. Anna was facing the TV, as though she might not even have been part of the conversation. If she'd been ordered to sit down, or forced to sit, she would have been facing into the room where the killer was. She wouldn't have been facing the TV. He quickly checked the end table for any possible effort by Anna to leave something behind. A scribbled name, anything. Felt foolish doing it, but would have felt more foolish if he hadn't, and something was found later. Nothing. The books were a novel by Martha Grimes, and a slender volume entitled Revelation, which turned out to be, indeed, the Book of Revelation. Virgil muttered, to nobody but the ghosts, "And I saw, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him." He checked the table by Russell's reading light. Nothing interesting. Drifted out of the shooting area through the rest of the place. A den opened off the dining room, with file cabinets and an older computer. A hallway next to the den led to a big bathroom, but without a tub or shower. The public bath. And three large bedrooms, each with a full bath. He walked through the master bedroom, looking, not touching, and into the kitchen. He was in the kitchen when he heard the sound of a vehicle outside. He went back to the front door and found a sheriff's patrol car stopped behind his and a deputy looking at his license plate. He stepped out on the porch, and the deputy's hand drifted to his hip, and Virgil called, "Virgil Flowers, BCA." Across the way, at the next house down the ridge, he could see a man standing in his backyard, watching them with binoculars. The deputy said, "Larry Jensen. I'm the lead investigator for the sheriff." Jensen was another of the tall, thin types, burned and dry, sandy hair, slacks and cowboy boots, sunglasses. They shook hands and Jensen asked, "See anything in there?" "Nope. I'd like to come back later and go through those file cabinets." "You're welcome to." Jensen turned and waved at the man in the next yard, who waved back. "That's the guy who ratted you out." "Too bad he wasn't watching the night the Gleasons were killed," Virgil said. "Got that right." Jensen was easy enough. Took him in the house, told him how he thought the killings must have happened, and his reconstruction jibed with Virgil's. They walked through the rest of the house, including the basement, and on the way back up, Jensen said, "I have the feeling..." He hesitated. "Yeah?" "I have the feeling that this was something that stewed for a long time. I went through every scrap of business dealings that the Gleasons had in the last 10 years. I've talked to about every single person that they knew. Interviewed the kids and the kids' spouses. I have the feeling that this goes back to something we don't know about. I'm thinking, Russell was a doctor. What if he did something bad to somebody? You know, malpractice? What if back there somewhere, years ago, he killed somebody? Or maybe didn't save somebody. A wife or somebody's daddy. And they just stewed and stewed, and now they snapped. I mean, Russell dealt with a lot of death in his time. He was a county coroner for years. And what if it goes back to something that just happened? Like happens to all doctors." Virgil nodded. "That's a whole deep pit." Jensen nodded. "When I worked through it, I decided that it meant everybody in the county would be a suspect. So, it's meaningless." Virgil said, "I got a question for you, but I don't want you to take offense." "Go ahead." "Did your office ever issue 357s to your deputies?" "Yeah, you could have gone all day without asking me that," Jensen said. "We did. But years ago, we went to high-capacity 40s when the FBI did." "What happened to the 357s? "That was before my time. As I understand it, guys were allowed to buy them at a discount. Some did, some didn't. Tell you the truth, some went away. We don't know where. Record-keeping wasn't what it should have been. This was 2 sheriffs ago, so it doesn't have anything to do with Jim."
"But you thought of that," Virgil said.
Sure.
They talked for another 15 minutes, and Jensen said that he was looking through medical records at the partnership that had taken over Gleason's practice, and also at the regional hospital.
It's buried back there somewhere.
Maybe the same guy killed Bill Judd. If Judd is really dead, he and Gleason were almost exactly the same age, so there's got to be a tie. Maybe this killer guy is waiting to go after somebody else, sitting out there thinking about it.
Could have gone all day without saying that, Virgil said.
Virgil followed Jensen back into town, cut away when Jensen turned north toward the courthouse. The motel clerk had recommended two lunch spots, Earnhardt's Cafe and Johnny's Pizza, both on Main Street. Virgil decided Italian might be too much and checked out Earnhardt's. The cafe turned out to be a combination German deli and bakery. Cold meat, fresh baked potato bread, pickles, and sauerkraut. Virgil got a roast beef on rye with rough mustard, a pickle, and a half pound of bright yellow potato salad, and took it to one of the low back booths that lined the wall opposite the ordering counter. A minute or so after he sat down, the sheriff's sister stepped in, blinked in the dimmer light, said hello to the woman behind the counter, ordered a salad and coffee, spotted Virgil in the back booth, and nodded to him. He nodded back, and a moment later she carried her lunch tray over and slid into the seat on the other side of the booth.
"Are you going to save Jimmy's job?" she asked.
She was not perfectly good-looking. Her eyebrows might have downsloped a little too much. Her mouth might have been a quarter inch too wide. But she was very good-looking, and certainly knew it. She was smiling when she asked her question, but her green eyes were serious.
"Does it need saving?" Virgil asked.
"Maybe," she said. "And?"
"My name's Joan Carson. Jimmy said you had some nice things to say about my ass."
"Jimmy's job just got in deeper trouble," Virgil said. But she was still smiling, and that wasn't bad.
"Tell me about that, though, his job."
She shrugged, dug into her salad.
"This is his second term. Most sheriffs